Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy Marty here to introduce this week's episode with James Chang, who's in town as part of the Chain Code residency, doing some incredible stuff. James is an incredibly humble man, incredibly intelligent man. We had a far wide-ranging discussion, everything from Lib Bitcoin to Taproot to energy, and solar and renewable energy in particular. I must warn you, freaks, I'm sorry. I must apologize up front. While we were recording, my idiot self had the leg chair of my chair sitting on James's mic line. I did not notice until after we had recorded. I was worried that it was going to affect the audio after I hit stop record, and my worries were warranted because James's audio is a little gravelly at times. I contemplated not posting this, but I feel that the conversation is still able to be listened to if you can put up with the noise, and it's an important one, I think. So I hope you guys enjoy, despite the audio issues, and I know this is an issue that plagues this podcast in particular, and just know that we are working on upgrading the sound equipment as I speak, and this is hopefully a problem that should not be a problem in the future going forward very soon. This episode of Tales from the Crypt is also brought to you by the Cash App. You freaks already know all about it. They're helping us stack sats. They're helping us save money at merchants. And now they're letting us send and withdraw Bitcoin to and from the app, which is pretty cool. They're letting you send to BEC32 addresses as well. So if you want to send straight from Cash App to Wasabi or another coin joining service like Samurai, that is totally possible now. And then on top of that, they got the Boost card. You can personalize that. I used it this morning again. Another high time preference move. Went and bought coffee, but I did save a dollar. And every time I go to Whole Foods, I use it, save 5%. So go down to your local app store today, whether it's Google or Apple, download the Cash App, and then when you download it, make sure you use the promo code STACKINGSATS, one word, that's STACKINGSATS. You're going to get $5, and then $5 is going to go to a charity, Owls Lacrosse, which is very near and dear to my heart, doing great things in Chicago. Again, that's Stacking Sats, one word, $5 to you, $5 to Al's. Hope you guys enjoy this, despite the audio troubles we had. James, again, incredibly humble, incredibly smart, and we're lucky to have him working on Bitcoin. Tales from the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy, Marty Bent. Back in the foreign Chainco Lab studio. It's always a pleasure to be here. I'm sitting down with somebody I'm very excited to speak with, who's relatively new to Bitcoin, but has done an immense amount in the, what did you say, year and three quarters that you've been into it?
Yeah, roughly.
And so I'd like to introduce you freaks to James Chang, who's the founder of teachingbitcoin.io. We've been shooting the shit here for like the 15 minutes, and you're a very fascinating person. You've got a...
Marty, that's very kind of you. Thanks for having me on. Look forward to talking to you. Yeah.
No, so thanks for agreeing to sit down with me. I always feel very very what's the word I'm looking for? Very honored to be able to come here and speak to the people working on the Bitcoin Core, or not Bitcoin Core, just on Bitcoin in general. That's it. Actually, you shouldn't say Bitcoin Core because you start out in Lib Bitcoin, which is
right.
I want to start with.
Right.
And what we usually do here on Tales from the Crypt is, mm-hmm. How did you find Bitcoin? What sort of drove you towards Bitcoin? And how did you first sort of learn about this whole network?
Yeah. I want to say I first learned about Bitcoin like back in 2014, 15. I was on vacation. I remember this. I haven't told this story that frequently, but I was on vacation in Japan, in Tokyo, and we had just arrived. And I read this news article about, I can't remember, was it a price hike or whatever is in the news, and I started reading about it, and I didn't sleep for the entire night. Like my partner was lying in bed right next to me, and so I ended up taking the phone to the bathroom where I could turn the lights on and continue googling this thing on Bitcoin. But I kind of ignored it for years. I ignored it for years.
So you had like an initial rush, 24-hour period where you googled the hell out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what were you doing before you came to work on the Bitcoin protocol?
I think I was running my own software firm back then. We were doing solar, we're building a solar simulation tool for people who wanted to, you know, kind of figure out whether it was economical to run a solar power plant with perhaps battery storage at their homes. So we built a web tool for that, with which where you could upload your consumption data. So you can see like what kind of battery capacity makes sense, whether that west-facing roof actually produces when you actually consume at home. So that's a product I worked on for about 2 years. But that it was during that time that I learned about Bitcoin. And yeah, I was fascinated by that, but at the same time, for some reason, it just drifted away. Like I never chased it. Like I never, you know, spent more time or effort to really improve my understanding of what Bitcoin was.
So what was the catalyst to sort of make you pay more attention to this?
I don't know. That's a great question. I want to say nothing really unique. I mean, I guess 2017, 18, a whole wave of people were introduced to Bitcoin through the media and the price increase. And quite frankly, I'm you know, the same, whatever affected those people affected me. And so like a lot of communities locally probably just reached, like these meetup communities probably reached some kind of critical mass, and I got swept away with everybody else. And for me personally, like I really want to understand the technical aspect of how Bitcoin worked. I think that was something that was important to me. Like I really want to understand like how this stuff works, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what brought me here, I guess.
Yeah, and you've done a great service in the fact that you've been teaching people sort of your journey, what you've learned with teaching Bitcoin.io.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is you like got your chops learning about LibBitcoin and that implementation in particular.
Right.
So how did you attack learning how LibBitcoin works? How does,
yeah,
we'll get into that eventually, like how LibBitcoin, yeah, works compared to Bitcoin Core. And
yeah,
what you told me you took a couple train rides to Milan to go to,
right,
Giacomo's meetup, and you met Eric Lasko.
Yeah. 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 So this is like February last year. And as I told you before, like I had, you know, I could take the train in Switzerland for free. So I'm living in Switzerland close to Zurich at this time, and I can take the trains for free. So Giacomo's back then was in Milan. His meetups were about 3 hours away by train. So I realized I could go there for almost free. Just pay for the small trains ride segment across from like Ticino to Milan. So I went a couple times, and on one of these meetups, I Eric Voskel was speaking, and he was speaking about a couple topics he had added to his crypto economics work. And I still remember the first article that, and I read it the day he showed up. I was like, who is this guy, and what is he going to talk about? What is he, crypto economics? And the article that I read was called The Dedicated Cost Principle. The Dedicated Cost Principle is fantastic. You guys should go check it out. But basically it explains why, like if you try to do mining and you try to use, let's say, waste heat, or you try to produce any kind of secondary product that has some kind of marketable value, like Eric will argue that, or actually prove, if you accept the premise, that like there's no energy saved through that. And we can go into why, but it explained like a very specific aspect of mining, which I had questions about myself, but nobody really answered, and economists talk about a lot. And
yeah, let's dive into something that fascinates me as well. So what is the premise that we have to accept that he proves?
Yeah,
that makes it so, right, that he proves this is correct.
Right, yeah, right. I guess one is, for example, you know, like you have to accept that there is a free market, right? Mm-hmm. So miners compete freely. So like if it's a free market and there's no, you know, hurdle to entry, we can all start mining tomorrow. So if let's say you are particularly profitable as a miner, so if somebody's particularly profitable, or the mining market as a whole is particularly profitable, then capital will necessarily come in and join the market because they're getting better returns, right? So over the long run, the tendency for the mining market is that the margins tend to go to zero. So if somebody starts mining and they can kind of extract some marketable value from waste heat, now they're mining with higher margins, and everybody starts doing that, more capital will join the market, more miners will come online, and that competition just drives that margin back down to zero. Can't dip below zero because then miners will leave, right? So, that's a very logical fact that you can reason about, and if you accept that, you know, like capital can join and capital can leave, and they're free markets, then that all kind of makes sense. That all explains it very nicely.
It's the waste heat basically being used first to cut costs somewhere else, where maybe like cleaning water or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Right.
That's fascinating. And yeah. This whole,
I mean, there's so many chains that are. Like there are chains that attempt to utilize a different proof of work or proof algorithm to produce some kind of alternative marketable product, thereby supposedly saving energy or making things more efficient. But the cost has to be dedicated to mining, otherwise, or in other words, the cost needs to be dedicated to the security of the coin. Otherwise, it's yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, it's crazy how extensive Eric's crypto economics Wikipedia page is. That wiki,
insane.
It's a trove of great sort of thoughts on Bitcoin and economics
absolutely.
In general.
Absolutely.
And we could go down crazy rabbit holes just talking about that wiki in particular,
right?
And mining in particular. So, do you think your experience like creating the solar simulation tech sort of helped you understand this stuff better? Or?
I was very, I've become very, very disillusioned by alternative energy.
Why is that?
Through the subsidies and how the markets work or don't work.
Mm-hmm.
I think we see that now. You know, there's like increasingly little capacity being added, at least in the Western world, partly because the subsidies are being withdrawn slowly. And you also see like where a lot of overcapacity is being built because of artificial incentives like you know local or federal subsidies and these capacities may or may not actually benefit the system as a whole. I'll give you one example like in Germany till this day like they heat railroads like the what do you call them the rails
the rails
right
train tracks
yeah you know what the kind of yeah train tracks basically and you know they have a lot of these have heating systems so that during winter like they don't ice over. And so there in a lot of these sections they have heating systems and they will actually heat these tracks during the summer because the grid the national the grid in Germany cannot find a buyer or taker for the excess capacity during peak production times
because
mm-hmm. it's like sunny all over the continent right
yeah and is this renewable energy in particular or
this in this case is solar. A lot of it is solar. Yeah. I mean, I know they do a lot of other things like wind and, but in particular these peaks during summer where everybody's just producing wattage, right? And so that's like whenever I hear the energy efficiency argument, I'm always a little skeptical. Yeah. And.
No, and that's what you were actually alluding to earlier when your product is to help people recognize when they're profitable.
Right.
Given because that's the thing with solar and wind in particular, right? It's like
right.
you could have a cloudy day or a yes. stretch where there's no wind. You
yes.
this is sort of a uncertainty of when you'll have 100% power and how much power.
100%, 100%, and then that variability in production capacity, that's also a cost,
mm-hmm.
right? You either need to store or you need to find a way to buffer, and a lot of these aren't factored in. Again, through these subsidy schemes, where for every kilowatt hour you produced, the state would reimburse you, very very good rate. But that does not take into account the fact that sometimes the sun doesn't shine at all, or sometimes everybody's producing but we're not consuming. So it's just when the market mechanism is kind of overridden by policy, top down policy, you tend to see a lot of inefficiencies and things don't work.
Yeah. So you think you were you seem like to be a huge fan of the free market. Do you think Bitcoin made you that way, or were you that way and you found Bitcoin and sort of it clicked?
I think Bitcoin's given me a lot of that education. In fact,
mm-hmm.
right? I am in many ways, and I was very average person in my thinking and. In my indoctrination, I would never argue that. I don't think I can argue that that's changed that much. I think I'm still victim, or I'm still in that sense, very average person. I consume the same information everybody else does, but Bitcoin definitely has has introduced me to this world, like Austrian economics or just rational thought, and you know, these mental, like these, I think a lot of the things that you hear about in Bitcoin space are, you know, like little logical thought experiments, right? Bitcoin in a sense is also like it's a really cool thought experiment, like what if,
right,
you created like the market money and anybody can, yeah, and it's a P2P system, and here we are. So
I mean, this question's nagging you so much that you've been driven to write code for the protocol.
I'm not a prolific contributor.
Well, to contribute.
Yeah, yeah. Like
whether or not I mean, and that'll be decided in history, I bet, or
yeah,
in retrospect. Could go a little down, a little cosmic tangent there, but we'll stop ourselves from that. But no, whether or not you recognize this, you are so fascinated by this, it seems to me, at least, that now you're here at Chaincode doing a residency, yeah, for the summer,
and right.
You spent hours diving, so you dove through every line of code in LibBitcoin, or not every line of code, a lot of it.
No, but I looked at a lot of the lot of different interfaces that LibBitcoin has internally, and they were very instructive to my understanding of how Bitcoin works.
So yeah, let's walk through that. What in particular, cool, like where did you start, and how did it all sort of come together? So for me, for probably the first 5 or 6 years on this journey, not that everything's fully formed in my mind, it's definitely more formed than it was in the beginning, but everything sort of like floated above my head, just like disparate ideas that eventually, yeah, over time you put together. So did you have that experience looking at the code base?
I felt the same way. I started out just trying to figure out like what transactions are, and I had trouble doing that, like I'd run, you know, the core daemon and the RPC interface, the command line, and then I struggled to get a deeper understanding beyond just the RPC interface, and so but then I had trouble really understanding like how to work myself through core. LibBitcoin's really, really nice in that aspect. Like it's an alternative implementation. It's a completely different architecture than core itself. A lot of different design decisions. I'll leave it up to the user to decide whether it's, you know, it's better for him or her or not. But it's got a lot of very nice internal interfaces, so that the user of the Bitcoin, either as a full node, as a command line tool, or perhaps just as a library, it's very, you know, the interfaces are very structured and clear, and so you can use the Bitcoin as a very modular toolkit. You can decide, like, let's say I just want to build a wallet, so I'm just going to use the transaction library. If I want to build, like, you know, maybe some SPV client, I don't want to have actually a full node, I'm going to use the PDP node class, and so I just run a PDP object that connects automatically to the different to the Bitcoin network. Or perhaps I want to run a node without a server, I want to develop my own server, that's something I can do too. So from day one, they've actually structured the library, so you know, it's almost like Lego. You can pick and take whatever you need.
That's the one thing that fascinated me when Eric came to BitDevs last summer and presented, yeah, the Bitcoin, is I didn't know, yeah, it didn't have a UTXO. It doesn't work on the same UTXO model that Bitcoin, yeah, Core does. It's more, yeah, transaction index based, right?
Yeah, there's a transaction database. I mean, maybe a step back, like because it's an alternative implementation, they took different design choices. And when we talk about like the mempool or the UTXO set, it turns out like we're often talking about core specific implementation data structures. So in LibBitcoin, there's no mempool per se, because they're simply transactions which are all stored in the transaction database. It's a memory map file, so it's they've rolled their own database in that sense. It's a very clean, it's a very nicely written database, database template that they also use for blocks and headers, and the headers then point to the transactions, so thereby creating blocks. And so if you want to know what transactions are unspent, they're just flagged in the transaction database as unspent.
Mm-hmm.
There's no separate data model that says this is the UTXO set. Yet we talk about it all the time. It's kind of entered the Bitcoin, what do you call
vernacular.
It?
Vernacular.
Vernacular. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's every intermediate user of Bitcoin will know what a UTXO set as a mental model.
Yes.
But it only has its origins at in I think in a implement in an implementation design choice.
I know it's definitely very deeply seated in my mind as sort of the mental framework from which I approach using and interacting with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
The UTXO set.
Right. I mean, there arguably is a UTXO set in the Bitcoin. It's just not, you know, like an explicit explicit data model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So. Were you learning about LibBitcoin and Core in parallel, or
No. I was just learning about LibBitcoin, and then eventually I started. So I got invited to do. I was teaching at Swiss universities, but I was teaching like Ethereum stuff. you know, like the ICO market was going crazy in Switzerland, and so every university till now they will offer some kind of smart contract. Or blockchain course. And so that was what I was doing. Yeah.
Were you, was that sort of what fascinated you first? Was Ethereum, or was that just a job, or were you?
I had to confess, like,
intrigued.
No,
by it?
I was generally intrigued by this thing, and it's so accessible. Like, there's like this web IDE, and there are smart contract templates, and within 10 minutes, you've deployed your first contract, and that's really the allure, I think, of something like Ethereum, is how fast you can get a web developer up to speed.
Mm-hmm. And so are you still a fan of Ethereum? Would you?
I mean, it's what it is. I mean, I think all Bitcoiners know the trade-offs. They're pretty apparent.
Mm-hmm.
in the design choices that they made. I think it's a great teaching tool. Till this day, I think it's a fantastic teaching tool. If people want to understand like what state chains is, and like it's very hard for somebody to write a Bitcoin script. It's not accessible.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, but like a Ethereum Solidity contract, you know, it's if somebody can read JavaScript, they can follow that. Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's
and then the rush of creating your first coin in Solidity, it's like it's a non-trivial experience. I still think that's one of the greatest learning tools out
What's
there.
What's the process like?
You know, you just create a contract in Solidity, and you decide how the coins are going to be created. There are many ways you can do it. You can do it by time interval. You can do it by proof of work, right? I can implement a very basic proof of work scheme in a Solidity contract. And so the basic principles of how Bitcoin works are reflected there, but in a way that I can teach in, like, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah. Do you think Bitcoin's scripting capabilities, being as limited as they are, or as difficult as they are to interact with, is that a benefit or a net negative in the long run?
No, I'm absolutely. I think it's. I mean, there are legacy decisions that have flown in there, but overall, I think it's actually a good thing.
Okay.
It's a good thing that it's so restrictive.
Okay.
So
let's do this. Let's try to.
It's easier to reason about, I guess, is the way to put
okay.
it. Yeah.
Can we break down like what a scripting language is and within a blockchain, like what its purpose is, and why you might want it to be a little more basic or simple than Solidity or something like that?
Solidity, yeah. No, that's super interesting. I'm currently studying Peter Willey's Miniscript stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it took me a while to figure out like what Miniscript is. And so basically, Miniscript is saying, actually, even though scripting language in Bitcoin compared to other blockchains seems restrictive already, we actually can reduce it even more.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter Willey and Andrew Polstra said, well, we're going to reduce it even more. We take a subset, and we're going to. It's been formally verified. All these building blocks are so well understood, and these building blocks are nothing than. You know, they're just script templates. They're like chunks of Bitcoin script opcodes,
mm-hmm.
which you can then use and compose a more complicated like spinning logic.
Okay.
And because they've thought so much about all these little chunks, all these little, if you will, all these little templates have certain properties, malleability properties, correctness properties, and they've all defined them very. You know when you put these things together. What the property will be of the resulting, you know, final composed Bitcoin script.
And it's like a straightforward function almost?
I think that, like, actually compiling these mini scripts are, I think it's not quite trivial, but the basic idea is because I've understood the building blocks so well and how their properties relate to each other and how the properties change when I compose them into a more complicated script. The user doesn't have to worry about whether a script is malleable, whether all possible spending conditions are safe or not safe. Right, and so it just provides a more robust way to design outputs mm-hmm. in the future.
And Miniscript's agnostic, right? It's not. It's chain agnostic. It could be used for multiple protocols, or.
Yeah, I guess if another chain adopted Bitcoin script,
yeah.
It could definitely work on another chain as well. Yeah, it's really just a scripting language.
Yeah. So what's and you've been working on Taproot as well, correct?
Pardon?
Been working on Taproot as well.
Yeah,
correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Do they
yeah.
like so? This is like. Again, I'm adult. I've said this before. I am an adult, but I'm also adult when it comes to this stuff. And so for me, like terms like Miniscript, Taproot.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put Schnorr in there. I sort of understand Schnorr pretty well at this point. But like Raproot, Musig, those four or five concepts or ideas sort of are amoebously associated together in my mind.
Yeah.
But they're very different. As well,
yeah.
And sort of, how do they interact with each other, or do they even interact?
Yeah, First of all, I have to say, like, I don't claim to be an expert of any of these topics you just mentioned, right? Like, I can tell you about what my journey has been. So Taproot is fascinating for me because, well, for one, it's introduces Schnorr into Bitcoin, so that's great. So like, Schnorr has two aspects. One is it makes verification cheaper because we can batch verify, and so for the system at the network it's good because let's say IBD will be less costly, initial block down will be less costly because verification happens more efficiently. But for the end user, for the person who's actually spending Bitcoin, the question is like, why would you care? Why do I care if like transactions verify faster?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my node might run more efficiently, but like once I'm synced up, do I really care? So that's more like a system level benefit. I think for a user level benefit, like that's where Taproot comes into play. Like Schnorr allows us to do things like I want to say tweak signatures, but I'm not sure if that's unique to Schnorr.
Mm-hmm.
But that's definitely what Taproot does. So Taproot introduces Schnorr. Taproot also introduces or hides a bunch of alternative spending paths inside a, you know, like this normal SegWit looking output.
Okay.
Right. So it's like, yes, it's Schnorr, but it's also like, because of Schnorr, we can also create these alternative hidden spending paths, which are only visible on chain if I actually use them. I think the observation that one can make is like, if you look at Lightning, most of the times, you know, all these HTLCs and revocation paths, they're mostly not executed. We'll have nodes will have a collaborative close, mm-hmm. and, which is both signed, and you don't see this complicated scripts on chain. And then Taproot's a similar idea. It's like, we can create this output which has all these complicated spending paths or enforcement paths, but most of the time we will never actually use it.
Yeah, interesting. It's and so we were talking about this also before we hit record, is trying to figure out how to soft fork this stuff into the protocol, and
I don't even know.
Yeah, like, no.
But
that's what you're saying, you missed the SegWit.
Yeah.
Fork wars.
Yeah.
And that's a big I don't want to say hurdle, but just a weird constraint that we've been giving.
Right.
Frustrating this.
Right.
And, so, you're helping contribute to a BIP that would implement this stuff, correct?
So I'm not contributing to the BIP. The BIP has been written and proposed by Peter Willey and I think a lot of other people. But I'd like to provide a Python library with which people can start playing around and getting more familiar with what you can do with Taproot.
Mm-hmm.
So like convenience methods, if you want to construct a path like a Taproot. So Taproot has this interesting like Merkle tree structure where you can, and you're entirely free to design this tree the way you want. There are trade-offs in terms of how long the Merkle proofs are, and that affects whether a spend is more expensive than the other. So there are all these subtleties that I think people need to play around with so they can actually have an opinion. Like, I have to be quite frank, having having not used Taproot for that long, like I barely have an opinion.
Yeah.
And so it takes time for somebody to get familiar with the proposal, the way it's, you know, how the proposal is implemented right now. And then thirdly, then to provide feedback.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that may be the goal, to have a more inclusive, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe
that's moving it from a theoretical level to an experimental level.
Yeah. 100%. 100%.
Action.
100%.
Which is 100%. What you want to see, right? It's like, hey, 100%. Figure out if it works or if it doesn't.
100%. And people get creative with the ways they want to use this stuff. Mm-hmm. I do believe. So I do hope if I can help them make that access to Taproot a little easier, that'd be awesome.
Well, thank you for working on it.
Well, hey, like Chaincode's providing me with the opportunity to do so. So
well, thanks for providing a segue. How's your summer been? So how did you get hooked up here? Like, obviously you submitted a an application and
I just applied.
Accepted you, but.
I just applied. I'd known a couple guys here just from the meetups and conferences, but I basically just applied. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage anybody else who I hear they're going to do this again. So I'd recommend it to anybody. It's been a really awesome experience.
What's the process been like? How is the summer been, and sort of open ended when you first start? Correct.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's quite a luxury. You basically come here. You're asked what you want to work on when you're applying, and then you just kind of make something up, right? you're like, this seems something very interesting that I'd like to work on, but you don't really know until you start picking it apart or start actually working your way towards that. And I initially wanted to just get more familiar with Core, right? I studied Libitcoin quite extensively. I'd done a lot of Bitcoin training with Libitcoin, but a lot of the future work, like Taproot, for example, is done in the Core community. And so I wanted to get more familiar with Core, and it turns out like right now I'm not even contributing to the actual Core code base. Mm-hmm. I'm building this library on the Core test framework, which is written in Python.
Okay.
Right. So you've got a lot of you've got like transaction classes there, block classes. And it's all written in Python, and it's used to test the C++ code in Core. Mm-hmm. It's like for integration tests. So I just build on top of that, and then people can just use it as a regular Python library.
Has Bitcoin Core learning curve been steeper than Libitcoin? Less steep?
It's definitely a little steeper.
Yeah.
It's definitely a steeper. It's like I've heard the term like it's like an evolved prototype in some ways.
Okay.
Like the Core software, you know, it's like you have a lot of people. It's the one with predominant market share.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't change the interface that quickly because people are actually using it a lot. You like a lot of these decisions in terms of how the wallet is structured and the node, et cetera, were made many, many years ago. So you can't make changes that quickly. Having said that, like after coming here, I realized there are actually a lot of people in at Chaincode working very hard to refactor a lot of different interfaces internally, which actually don't change behavior. So you as a user, you may not directly see the effect of that.
Now, yeah, we got Russ Yanofsky here.
Yeah, 100%.
Helping separate the wallet and the node, correct?
Right, exactly.
And that would
exactly
make it more modular, similar to Libitcoin, correct?
Right, 100%. That's kind of how I see that as well.
And it's as a user and somebody who's not an engineer, just thinking design-wise, that seems most advantageous is to separate that stuff, make it easier to work on individually. And
yes.
And so, yeah, we were talking about trade-offs with the scripting languages earlier and why you'd want them to be more sort of simpler. But the trade-offs, like, that's it's interesting. You're sort of, you're burdened to you're handcuffed to these trade-offs that were made almost a decade ago,
right,
with Bitcoin Core in particular. And
right.
I'm trying to think of like how I want to frame this question, and so there's like a sunk cost into how everything works, and I
didn't appreciate this until coming here. It's like the art of refactoring something that's complex as Core is, as I said, it's an incredible skill set. Like you know where you want to go. You know, like, it should look, this interface should look like this, but you have to break it down into a lot of little couple steps, and each step cannot break the product.
Yeah. Right? No, this is
it's like, and if it's too long, like, people won't review your PR, and when you break it down, every single piece has to be atomic in a sense. Like, it's got to be, you can't break things along the way, and so that's incredible. So,
yeah, that's what that's why I like the phrase, like, you're working on nuclear technology. Like, it's like live, and you have to treat it with that much respect. And I think the question I'm getting at here is, like, is there a point at which Bitcoin Core in particular will be sufficiently modular that it will, like, sort of launch pad, like, a growth and development and building on top of it?
I don't know. I think we will. I mean, looking at the people who are working on it, I'm pretty sure we'll reach a point where this modularity is in a good place. Whether that will, like, you know, bootstrap this entire wave of new features, and
or maybe
is that what you mean?
That, or maybe even get us closer to ossification, which theoretically seems like a good idea to me, but I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah, I don't know. People are free to do what they want. People are free to use what tools they deem right for the job. So I guess the users will decide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is crazy to see how much you do know, considering that you've only been studying this intently for the last year and a half, and you were very humble. Getting into residency and contributing in the ways that you are already is it's great to see, man.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks again. Thanks for doing it. We've got we're only 34 minutes in here, so we got plenty of time. Or do you have to get back to work?
No, take as long as you.
So when you were making the teaching Bitcoin.io like videos, was that an exercise that helped you learn, or did you feel compelled to get better information out there?
I did feel compelled to get better information out there. I ultimately didn't really find an audience.
Mm.
Like, I feel like there's a lack of quality information which was technically accurate or correct. I feel like there are not a lot of explanations which rely on analogies or, you know, like hand wavy metaphors, and I wanted something that was a little more precise. Having said that, I also realize the audience for that on YouTube is probably not huge. Right, like people will go to Bitcoin Stack Exchange. They'll read the BIPs themselves. They'll read the Lightning RSC.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's like, let's say that's the top of the pyramid, right?
Yes.
Like, people who really want to get deep, they'll find ways to do it. They'll read a lot. They'll educate themselves. So who are these videos actually for? Like, is it for an audience that doesn't have the time, or prefers like something that's a little easier to digest? They may perhaps not want all the detail, right? They may want something that's a little more high level. And so I think I failed to. It was a good experience for me, but at the same time, I think I didn't find the balance between the granularity of the content and the audience.
Yeah, no, it's tough.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why we do this podcast and the newsletter, and we're getting into videos now as well. But it's hard trying to find like the product market fit and education,
especially
in Bitcoin.
Yes,
you have developers who have to learn a certain way, and then you have users who have to learn about the system and interacting with it.
100%.
That's what I think is most lacking right now is education in the space.
Yeah.
How we make that better. So anybody putting in effort to make that better is A-okay in my book.
Yeah. Awesome.
What else? Like, what are your thoughts on the current state of Bitcoin, both from like a protocol development level, given how much you've seen in the last year and a half, and then at a social and basically a phenomena in the in the world?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't. Do you edit this?
I can edit it. Yeah.
Okay. Let me think about that.
Said another way, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I've been following the protests in Hong Kong in recent weeks. I don't know. You were talking about it. It does feel like, you know, the world is falling apart or just tearing apart, it seems.
Right. Like, well, that's what I'm trying to determine. Is the world falling apart at the seams?
I don't.
Or do we just have more access to how terrible it is today?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know. The fact that I can be here in New York, you know, on a whim, having never met these people before, that's amazing, right? Technology enables this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I can learn about Bitcoin from anywhere in the world, that's a privilege of being alive today.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real privilege, right? But at the same time, as you say, it's really hard to assess.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this access also makes it hard to assess, like, what's actually happened, ironically. Yeah,
yeah, what's... Like the access to information, yeah, I mean, all you freaks who read The Sovereign Individual, they predicted this, like, obviously, over-saturation of exposure to information will lead you to be...
Yeah.
Sort of lose grip with reality or what you perceived reality was.
And
that's what I think the information age is bursting people's preconceived notions of what reality is and how the world works. And I mean, we have a perfect example of this Jeffrey Epstein stuff going on over the weekend.
Right.
That overt quote-unquote suicide. But it's people are starting to, like, really question the institutions and the pillars
100%.
Of the status quo, if you will.
100%.
That's why, I mean, that's why I'm into Bitcoin, because I like to think that it provides an optimistic future or a hope of an optimistic system that can be built separate from this one in which I my reality used to be based around. And now, after years of sort of peeling back the onions and seeing how the world works, whether it be exposure to working in the markets or just exposure to our political system here in the United States, more particularly the last 8 years. It's it's interesting. That's why I'm so enthralled with Bitcoin, because it's something exciting to work on. And a little bit, I've said this before, punk rock and rebellious, if you will.
Right. Yeah. I guess because my first foray into Bitcoin came through the Eric Voskal crypto economics angle. I mean, the way he writes about it, I think is very accurate. It's like it's a tool of resistance, right?
Yeah, it's dark market money.
It's black market money.
Yeah.
Right.
And I love how he's very very cut and dry about that. Like, Bitcoin only succeeds if it's black market money.
Yeah.
And so, do you ever see if you had to envision Bitcoin being curbed or being stopped in the future, how do you imagine that would happen, or could it even happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just observed that you know, a lot of this, a lot of the, you know, like, how do people get into Bitcoin? They have some kind of exchange account. There are certain on-ramps, often almost exclusively KYC'd. And so these are all permission transactions, right? We're using Bitcoin, like, cryptographically. I'm signing something and I'm depositing some funds at an exchange or to some business. But it's all KYC. It's a permission transaction. Even though, like, the technology itself is pointless if it's a white market transaction.
Right.
Implicitly, because my identity is given. I presume, like, you know, if the state wanted to, or if the regulator wanted to, that could be an illegal. You know, it could be a legal transaction. So there's, like, this whole world of Bitcoin which is kind of like permissioned and white market, and it seems to make up the bulk.
Yeah, the majority.
Right, of what we see today.
And you can prove that with just looking at exchange wallets and seeing how much they hold. And now that worries me as well. And maybe there's some, like, crazy future in which Bitcoin, like, all the coins held on the exchange eventually, I mean, I don't know, maybe get locked up there, and you have just like the free floating Bitcoin people that actually took their control of their own private keys. And
they may very well be
right.
Like, two sets of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right.
I hope not. How can we prevent that from happening? What do you think? How do you think users should act, or can you even try to dictate how users act? Do you think people will just naturally coalesce to these, frankly, easier solutions? More convenient, I would say.
Yeah, like, it would seem like if the, so like, like the utility of Bitcoin today, probably as a black market money to most people is not very high. You know, a lot of it's like I think hodling for me is actually it's a speculative act. Like I hodl because I believe like the value will increase, right? That's there's an act of speculation there. The future is unknowable. Mm-hmm. But if I hodl, I'm making presumption about what the future will be, right?
Yes.
So if you like to like a speculative act, but as a medium of transfer to transfer value, we're just not quite there yet. I think you know very few people make trade in Bitcoin, and perhaps one day where that becomes like the utility of that. Is positive. Like I'm a freelancer and you're going to pay me in Bitcoin because otherwise my freelance activity would be illegal, or you know, like I would need to acquire a license very expensively, or you know,
yeah.
When we're at that point, I think the utility of Bitcoin becomes tremendous,
right? And then
tremendous.
And you see what's happening today, like in Argentina, where their currency collapses by I think 25% against the dollar overnight, and
it's nuts.
I checked the Bitcoin to Argentinian peso chart today, and it's nearing an all-time high, while the Bitcoin to U.S. dollar pair is still 42% below its all-time high. So,
yeah.
The utility is also relative. So, like Bitcoin is probably, or is it relative? What would Eric say about that? I just had Eric pop like.
No, that's not true. Like it's relative to alternatives.
Is there more Bitcoin have more utility in Argentina compared to the U.S. right now, right? Because the alternatives are better here.
Absolutely. That's absolute possibility. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like the competition to Bitcoin is just alternative money that we could use in a transaction.
That's the other thing. Like, so there was people saying last week, because I mean that's and I'll be frank here. I've said it on this podcast and written about it a lot, like speculating that. Mm. I think it focused on China and Hong Kong in particular, that
right.
there was probably capital flows into Bitcoin from
right.
Chinese nationals trying to get out of their system.
Right.
But
right.
A couple people last week, at the end of last week, were saying if you look at Chinese exchanges in particular, Bitcoin and Tether are trading at like a 1.5% to 2% discount, which would signal that there isn't that much demand. But then you get into the question, if it is truly dark market money,
yes.
maybe they're selling and trading on WeChat or something like
yes.
that and doing
interesting P2P. yeah
like how will you ever really know
especially
if it is dark market money like the true saturation and overall use within a particular country
because the stuff on the exchanges that's like the KYC stuff
yes.
so maybe it's that's why it's true. I don't know, I'm making this stuff up. Right, so I don't know but it just seems like you know Hong Kong maybe it's a flashpoint for something bigger, who knows. Like That's kind of how I feel about the situation right now. It's like,
the Hong Kong situation in particular is
it's pretty nuts.
Pretty nuts.
Yeah.
They shut down the airport yesterday. Canceled every flight.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
shut down the airport. I've been following their updates on Twitter. It's like, it seems like it's just an incredibly organized movement with support
gosh.
From such a broad swath of population. I think that's unique. That's different from, like, say, 2014.
Yeah, it was like 30% showed up to the marches, maybe more, which is
right.
crazy.
Right. And like, anecdotally, like, people from all ages are supportive. Like, I just don't see how there's a obvious like solution to this to this movement.
Yeah.
Which makes it so precarious, I guess.
No, it's. I've been observing it like very anxiously, right? Like, it just makes me very anxious to see how heated it's getting, and if China does push back, how hard will they push back? And are we about to see something like pretty fucked up on the global stage?
Yeah. Big time.
Yeah. But turning back to Bitcoin's dark market money, I think it made me think about this this conversation, like, which makes me believe that, like, so I can't prove this because I'm not in China, I'm not on WeChat, but I do, I surmise that there is a lot of dark market activity with Bitcoin in particular, just trading it, if that's it. I would surmise that's happening because there was actually a Vice documentary.
Mm-hmm.
They actually took it down. But it was on like credit card fraud,
In China?
No, in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
And, like, followed this gang in Atlanta that figured out this credit card identity theft scheme. But, like, Bitcoin was a very integral part. They're going to Bitcoin ATMs, buying Bitcoin in cash, buying the information online, and then using it as black market money.
Wow.
Doing that. But that isn't reported much here in America, but criminals in America are obviously using that way. And I don't want to say the Chinese are criminals, Chinese citizens are criminals or anything, but it's illegal there, and they may be using it in a similar fashion as well.
Right. Totally imaginable. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
No, neither do I. Yeah. These are all cosmic musings of two Bitcoiners. Yeah. What else are you excited for in the world of Bitcoin?
What else?
Like any consumer apps or wallets or
hardware
that you're excited for?
No, not really. That's kind of the contradiction of Bitcoin for me. Like, I'm super excited about the idea, the protocol. You know, like the protocol implementation. I'm less excited about products because I just don't. I'm not a user.
No.
I'm not a user of these products, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Like, I don't trade in Bitcoin. Like, I don't get paid in Bitcoin. I don't. So, like, Bitcoin as a medium of transfer is not something I use yet.
Yeah.
I'm just enthralled by the idea, and I want to, like, I believe in it, and it's in a way obvious to me, but I'm not a user day to day, and I think that's why it's hard for me to.
If you're hodling, you're a user. That's not that's correct misinformation. You are using it just as a savings tool.
Right.
And no, but it's something I think about a lot, like what the timing of this quote unquote industry and where we are on the timeline of Bitcoin. Inception and when it will be, or if it will be like a mass market tool, and when like a new internet like system will be on top of it, maybe very. I mean, obviously, because we have a lot of protocol things to figure out. Do we have a lot of protocol things to figure out? Could this be successful in perpetuity as is? Do you think?
That's a great question.
Yeah,
that's a great question. It would seem the alternatives so far haven't been that compelling. That seems like that's what the market is saying.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the basic utility of Bitcoin hasn't changed much. I guess the implementation has evolved and improved as its usage has increased in the network. And but yeah, generally the feature set seems to have been relatively constant, right? I mean, we have Lightning now, which is cool, but like coming back to like the daily I presume very few people actually use Lightning as a transfer medium, right? There's a novelty aspect in it, potentially, you know, like I guess there can be a lot of use cases for in the future, but where fees are on chain remain, you know, okay, it seems like it's still a while out before that becomes mainstream.
It's something I think about a lot. Like, is my screeching to this microphone even worth it at this point, right? Because it's still so nascent. I mean, I think so, but
yeah,
it's why just like hearing myself talk is take that into consideration. Well, thank you for joining me on this Monday afternoon.
My pleasure, Marty. This is great meeting you, and I know you've been doing this for a lot of years, and you've been putting a lot of content out there, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
Big thanks to you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for doing what you're doing. Thanks for putting out my random meandering line of questioning here. I feel like it was a splattering of questions there. And,
they're awesome.
No, it's because your background is seriously like crazy diverse, and your Bitcoin from Libitcoin to Bitcoin Core is not a common journey, I would say, for most people I've talked to on this podcast, at least. I think you're like the first Libitcoin. Did you contribute to the protocol too, or did you just?
I wrote a lot of documentation.
Yeah.
And I did. I went to a couple meetups with Eric to do like Libitcoin training for developers.
Okay, yeah. So you're.
Yeah.
First Libitcoin.
Yeah. Have you had him on the show?
I have not, but we're talking. He's actually gonna be in the city at the end of the month, I believe.
Awesome.
Or soon.
Awesome.
And we're going to try to make it happen.
Awesome.
Eric, if you're listening.
Awesome.
Let's make it happen.
Yep.
James, thank you for your time.
Cheers, Marty.
I'm going to stop bothering you.
Cool. You weren't. You weren't.
And keep doing what you're doing, man.
We'll
loving
do.
It. We'll Peace do. And love.
Bye, guys.
Take care.